G-Day, and welcome to the deep dive.
Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine you're right there on the scene of a really severe accident, just pure chaos unfolding, and right in front of you, the most critical situation imaginable. A patient in traumatic cardiac arrest, TCA. Every single second counts, you know. And the right decision, well, it can mean everything. So today we're diving deep into traumatic cardiac arrest, TCA, cutting through that intensity with some incredibly focused, protocol-driven wisdom. We've brought along two essential guides for our journey. One is a real-world standard operating procedure, SOP-04. It's straight from an Australian Air Medical Service, so you know it's forged in the crucible of real-life emergencies. And the other, a comprehensive review from MDocs, providing the broader context and the evidence that underpins these life and death decisions, our mission, to arm you with the critical knowledge needed to navigate these golden minutes.
Yeah, look, for a long time, the outlook for TCA has been incredibly bleak, no two ways about it. But what's genuinely surprising, I think, from these sources is that while it remains a formidable challenge, there are specific, identifiable situations where rapid, targeted interventions can actually turn the tide. This deep dive will hopefully eliminate those precise moments and equip you to understand how lives can truly be saved.
And trust me, some of the insights we're about to uncover will genuinely surprise you. We're going to explore how doctors and paramedics are trained to differentiate between blunt and penetrating trauma, what to do in those split seconds, and perhaps even more critically, what not to do. The fluid resuscitation recommendations, for example, they're a real curveball.
Exactly. It's not just about general resuscitation knowledge anymore, is it? The real leap is understanding how to apply that to the highly specialized, often counterintuitive management of a trauma patient in cardiac arrest. That's the powerful connection we're making today, moving you from the general to the profoundly specific, creating those sort of aha moments of clarity.
What really stands out from the sources, for me anyway, is the sheer scale of this problem. Traumatic injury isn't just a bump or a bruise. It's the leading cause of death for people aged 1 to 44 in industrialized nations. It's huge. And historically, cardiac arrest directly linked to trauma has had incredibly poor survival rates. It's a tough situation.
Yeah, absolutely tough. But there's a crucial nuance here. While the historical data painted a very grim picture, recent reexaminations show survival rates, though still challenging, are actually improving. Some studies report survival from, well, 0 up to 17%, with one even showing as high as 49.9% survival. And importantly, complete neurological recovery in a solid 6.6% of those cases. So it isn't necessarily a lost cause if the right actions are taken swiftly.
That's a critical distinction, isn't it? So unlike a standard metaural cardiac arrest, which can stem from countless underlying conditions, here we're often looking at a very specific, potentially reversible short list of problems. Does that focus reversibility fundamentally change the calculus of intervention, making it almost more hopeful in some ways?
Absolutely. Yeah, the MDocs review highlights precisely these critical reversible causes. We're talking about hypoxemia, a severe lack of oxygen, hypovolemia, massive blood loss. Then there's tension pneumothorax, which is a collapsed lung with a dangerous pressure buildup, and pericardial tamponade, where blood around the heart prevents it from pumping effectively. Now, while severe head trauma and upper airway obstruction are also causes, the first four are often the most urgent and, crucially, reversible in an emergency setting.
With such specific reversible causes at play, I imagine the window for effective intervention must be incredibly tight, almost brutally so.
You're spot on. We're talking about the golden 10 minutes. The mortality rate significantly increases once a patient has been in cardiac arrest for more than 10 minutes. The best outcomes really hinge on preventing the arrest entirely or rapidly reversing it before that clock runs out.
And this is where things truly diverge from general resuscitation, isn't it? Many people would instinctively think of chest compressions or adrenaline, but I gather that's often not the right play here.
Precisely. Yeah, a critical point the sources highlight is that in TCA, the presenting rhythm is most commonly pulseless electrical activity, or PEA. That means the heart has electrical activity on the monitor, but it's not actually pumping blood effectively. It's not a primary electrical problem with the heart. It reflects a low flow state, usually due to the underlying trauma. So standard advanced life support, or ALS algorithms like chest compressions and adrenaline, which are essential for medical arrests, are often ineffective or even potentially harmful in TCA because they just don't address the specific trauma-related issues like a collapsed lung or a massive blood loss.
Okay, right. So a crucial takeaway right off the bat. Not all cardiac arrests are created equal. Our sources make it crystal clear. You simply cannot treat all traumatic cardiac arrests the same way. The management approach fundamentally changes based on whether the trauma is blunt or penetrating.
Yeah, and to put this in context, blunt trauma, like what you'd see in a high-speed car crash or a nasty fall, often involves widespread internal injuries. That makes resuscitation incredibly challenging. Penetrating trauma, on the other hand, like a stab wound or a gunshot, might be more isolated, meaning direct intervention on that specific injury could be, well, potentially far more effective. This distinction truly sets the stage for everything that follows.
Right. So you'll see how the procedures diverge dramatically from this point forward, almost like two separate paths. Okay, let's start with blunt trauma. The Australian Aeromedical SOP paints a pretty grim picture for these cases. Outcomes are consistently described as extremely poor. It really hammers home that sometimes the most crucial decision isn't what to do, but when to recognize the limits of intervention.
That's a difficult truth, yeah. For blunt trauma, a key challenge for the clinician is really asking, when did the arrest actually occur? If the patient did not arrest within 10 minutes of your arrival, or, you know, there's a downtime of more than 10 minutes from the loss of vital signs, the protocol is unambiguous.
Yeah.
Your S-stop-P resuscitation. The likelihood of survival in these specific circumstances is virtually non-existent.
Wow. That's an incredibly difficult, almost gut-wrenching decision to make in the heat of the moment, isn't it? To essentially declare futility when every instinct screams to keep fighting. It really highlights the immense pressure clinicians face and how these clear protocols become their anchor.
It absolutely does. It's tough. But okay, if that 10-minute window hasn't passed, if the arrest is fresh, what's the immediate game plan? The clock is ticking, so speed is paramount. There are several rapid, high-impact actions you need to take. First, immediate airway management. This means intubation, using an LMA that's a laryngeal mask airway, a device to help keep the airway open, or bag valve mask ventilation, BVM. Crucially, sedation and paralysis are not recommended here, as they can delay intubation. It's often called cold intubation because we're intubating without those muscle relaxants. Also, important point, use low pressure, low frequency ventilation, and avoid P-positive and expiratory pressure, as standard ventilation settings can actually worsen circulation in hypovolemic patients. Second, you immediately perform bilateral finger thoracostomies. This is a crucial step to relieve any tension pneumothorax where air is trapped and building pressure around the lungs, squashing everything. The MDoc source emphasizes finger thoracostomy over needle decompression for its, well, greater effectiveness. Gets the job done better. Third, volume replacement. You need to rapidly site an IV, intravenous, or IO, intraosseous, into the bone marrow and start crystalloid fluid replacement. Now here's that curveball we mentioned earlier. While the Australian SOP suggests crystalloid initially, the MDoc source preferentially recommends packed red blood cells, PRBCs, as the initial fluid. Why? Because simply pouring in crystalloids can dilute the remaining blood, worsen clotting, and even increase inflammation. It can cause more harm than good in large volumes. The ideal is PRBCs at a 1:1:1 ratio with fresh frozen plasma, FFP, and platelets, actually replacing what's truly lost. If blood isn't immediately available, sure, crystalloid is the fallback, but the ideal is truly blood products. And fourth, hemorrhage control. This means managing any major external bleeding to stop the bleed. Apply a pelvic binder if needed, reduce any major long bone fractures. It's all about stopping further loss.
Right, okay. So if these immediate high impact actions actually work and you get a return of spontaneous circulation, ROSC, what's the next phase of the strategy then?
Good question. If these actions result in ROSC, that's when the patient's heart starts beating effectively on its own again, then you secure the airway properly, ensure you've got two good IV access points, and then, and only then, you switch to blood products for further volume resuscitation, following the established major hemorrhage protocols. That's a critical pivot in management, moving from basics to more refined care.
All right, but what if those immediate actions don't work? What's the next critical step in this blunt trauma scenario? Still feels pretty grim.
It is tough. If immediate actions are unsuccessful, you perform an ultrasound of the heart, a POCUS point-of-care ultrasound. If there's no evidence of pericardial tamponade, that's blood around the heart stopping at pump, or if you don't have ultrasound available at all, the protocol is clear again, SDOP. The likelihood of success is minimal, without specific findings that indicate a reversible cause you can actually fix.
Given the generally poor prognosis for blunt trauma, is there ever a case for a thoracotomy actually opening the chest in blunt trauma? It seems like such an aggressive intervention for such tough odds.
Look, it's exceptionally rare, and the sources stress it requires very specific conditions. The traumatic arrest must have occurred in front of you, meaning you witnessed it happen. The immediate actions we just discussed must have been unsuccessful. Tamponade must be present on ultrasound, and there could be no evidence of a major head injury. The survival rate for blunt trauma thoracotomy is only about 1.5% with a good neurological outcome, and only if all these very specific factors align. It's truly a last-ditch effort under highly selected circumstances.
Right, ha. Huh. Let's turn our attention now to penetrating trauma thing. Stab wounds, gunshot wounds. While still incredibly challenging, this scenario sometimes offers a slightly better, though still guarded, chance of survival, especially with extremely aggressive, targeted interventions. It's a different kettle of fish altogether, yeah.
Indeed it is. Similar to blunt trauma, for penetrating trauma, if there's been a loss of vital signs for more than 10 minutes, the protocol is again S-to-O-P. Same rule applies. But if the arrest is within that 10-minute window, a very different, far more invasive pathway opens up.
So in penetrating trauma, where a specific injury is often the culprit, it sounds like the whole approach shifts. What about something as fundamental as external cardiac compressions? Are we even doing standard CPR here?
That's a critical point, and one that often surprises people. A crucial insight from our sources, particularly the Australian SOP, is that for penetrating trauma, external cardiac compressions, or CPR, actually have no benefit. They are explicitly not recommended. Your efforts are much better spent on rapid, definitive surgical intervention.
No benefit. That really goes against conventional wisdom for cardiac arrest, doesn't it? Why is that the case in this specific scenario?
Well, it's because the underlying problem isn't usually an electrical issue where compressions can help circulate blood, like in a medical arrest. It's often a direct mechanical issue, a hole in the heart,
right,
or a major vessel bleeding out internally. CPR just doesn't address that mechanical problem, and in some cases, it could actually make bleeding worse by moving things around or increase pressure. It reinforces that targeted action is absolutely key here.
So if we're within that 10-minute window and dealing with penetrating trauma with CPR out of the picture, what's the rapid sequence of events look like?
Okay, if the TCA is less than 10 minutes, the actions are aggressive and rapid. First, secure the airway immediately, same as blunt trauma. Intubate LMA or BVM. Second, perform bilateral finger thoracostomy, starting with the site of injury. Got to rule out tension pneumothorax. Then, this is the game changer, perform a clamshell thoracotomy without delay. This means surgically opening the chest right across, like opening a clamshell, to directly access the heart and major vessels. The London HEMS, that's the Helicopter Emergency Medical Service, reported an 18% survival rate with pre-hospital thoracotomy for penetrating trauma under strict guidelines. It's pretty significant. And importantly, all survivors had a right ventricle penetrating injury causing cardiac tamponade and had the clamshell performed within 10 minutes of arrest. Speed and specific injury type matter. While the thoracotomy is happening, simultaneously you need teams securing IV access, giving crystalloid volume resuscitation before blood, unless blood is literally already hanging and ready to go, and monitoring the ECG through defibrillator pads. It's a highly coordinated, multi-pronged attack to get inside and fix the problem. Fast.
Okay, once that clamshell thoracotomy is performed, what are the outcomes and next steps? What happens then?
Right. If ROSC is achieved return to spontaneous circulation, then you start sedation, properly secure the airway if not already done, give TXA, tranexamic acid, which helps with clotting, and consider blood for volume resuscitation as per major hemorrhage protocols. If there's no ROSC, especially with a systole, that flatline, no electrical activity and a low ETCO2, that's end-tidal carbon dioxide, reflecting poor circulation, say below 10 mmHg, then the protocol is clear. Stop.
And once they're actually inside the chest cavity, what are they looking for specifically?
Upon opening the chest, the findings dictate the next steps. If tamponade is found, that collection of blood around the heart, you immediately evacuate the blood and control the bleeding source, maybe with fingers initially or sutures. If this leads to ROSC, then you consider clamping the internal mammary arteries to reduce further bleeding. If there's no tamponade and the heart is in a systole, STPJ. There's nothing surgically fixable there usually. However, if there's no tamponade, but there are signs of intrinsic heart activity, meaning organized electrical activity on the ECG, even without a pulse initially, you give volume resuscitation, primarily blood. You might also consider occluding the descending aorta against the thoracic vertebrae to increase blood flow to the brain and heart, or maybe performing a Hiller twist if there's massive lung bleeding. And then discuss the appropriateness of transfer with the medical coordinator. It's a very clear, structured algorithm for making critical decisions under pressure.
So in these critical moments, speed is absolutely paramount. Does ultrasound always have a role before opening the chest and penetrating trauma, or does it just slow things down too much?
This is a key distinction, yeah.
The Australian SOP specifically states ultrasound is not mandated prior to thoracotomy in penetrating trauma, precisely because it is likely to cause delay. The decision to proceed with thoracotomy should be immediate once clinically indicated based on mechanism, time, and vital signs. In this scenario, clinical judgment and speed trump confirmatory imaging. You just have to go.
Okay, let's zoom out a bit now and look at some crucial tools and maybe common misconceptions in managing TCA, as highlighted by our sources. There's some pretty important stuff here that challenges conventional thinking, Iran.
Definitely. A critical point the sources highlight is the role of point-of-care ultrasound, POCUS. It's invaluable, no doubt, for rapid identification of pericardial effusion causing tamponade and for massive hemoperitoneum significant internal bleeding in the belly. It's a quick way to identify two key reversible causes. However, and this is crucial, while incredibly useful, it should not delay other critical interventions like decompressive thoracostomy if clinically indicated. You don't want to get bogged down with imaging when a hands-on intervention is immediately required to save a life.
We touched on this earlier, but it's worth reiterating because it's so different from what many people might expect. The role of standard CPR in TCA.
Yeah, absolutely. To put this in context, many protocols have actually eliminated CPR after a patient arrives in the emergency department for TCA. As we discussed, CPR has little utility in hypovolemia when the tank is empty and can even worsen coronary perfusion by increasing the pressure inside the chest. Efforts should be laser-focused on reversing the underlying traumatic causes, stopping the bleeding, relieving pressure. The key exception, as you mentioned, is if a medical cardiac arrest predates or precipitates the trauma, for instance, a patient having a heart attack while driving and then crashing. That's when ACLS, advanced cardiac life support, might still apply, but it's a very different initial presentation.
And what about the use of vasopressors, like adrenaline? They're a cornerstone of medical arrests. Are they used in trauma?
Generally, no. The MDoc source, citing Smith et al., puts it pretty simply. There is no evidence to support the use of intravenous adrenaline in patients with traumatic cardiac arrest. In fact, early use of vasopressors in blunt trauma-induced hypotension, low blood pressure, has actually been linked to increased mortality. So current recommendations are generally against using these agents, except perhaps in specific rare cases like neurogenic shock, where the blood vessels are overly dilated due to a spinal injury. It's another powerful reminder that trauma protocols are highly specialized.
These are incredibly difficult conversations, but crucial ones in high-pressure situations. Knowing when to withhold or terminate resuscitation efforts, you can't just keep going indefinitely sometimes, can you?
No, you can't. And a key challenge then becomes, how do you balance that innate drive to save a life with the harsh reality of futility? Standard guidelines from organizations like the National Association of EMS Physicians and the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma serve as a framework for knowing when efforts can be withheld or discontinued. They focus on objective criteria like prolonged post-arrest time, unwitnessed arrest with no bystander CPR, those sorts of things, aiming to take the emotion out of the decision as much as possible, focusing on evidence-based markers of non-survival.
And then there's the added layer of complexity with children. Pediatric TCA is often described as a problem child in these protocols, isn't it? That sounds worrying.
Spot on. The pediatric population truly presents unique challenges in TCA protocols due to a few factors. There's a natural, understandable reluctance among medical providers to discontinue efforts in children. It's just incredibly hard. And studies do show increased rates of ROSC and survival in pediatric patients compared to adults, so there might be some justification. However, there's a significant lack of standardized protocols specifically for children in TCA. It's a real gap. So current guidance often focuses on obviously unsurvivable injuries, things like decapitation or rigor mortis setting in, or very prolonged out-of-hospital resuscitative efforts without response. More work is definitely needed here to establish clear, evidence-based guidelines for our youngest patients.
So what does this all mean for you, whether you're a clinician, a student, or just, you know, incredibly curious? We've journeyed through the intense world of traumatic cardiac arrest. We've clearly differentiated between blunt and penetrating trauma, understood the critical 10-minute window, and highlighted very specific interventions like finger thoracostomies and emergency thoracotomies.
Yeah.
It's a detailed, high-stakes blueprint for critical care, really.
Yeah, the broader implication here is that we're moving beyond general resuscitation protocols to highly specialized evidence-based approaches. It's not just about doing CPR on everyone. It's about rapid identification of those reversible causes, understanding when to be aggressively invasive, like with a thoracotomy, and crucially, knowing when to acknowledge futility to avoid needless intervention. It's not just about doing something. It's about doing the right thing for the right patient in the right time frame.
Absolutely. It's a powerful reminder that in these situations, knowledge isn't just power. It's potentially life-saving for the right patient. Getting it right when it matters most is everything.
Which really begs the question, doesn't it? In a high-stress, rapidly unfolding emergency, how do medical teams, both pre-hospital and in the emergency department, cultivate the discipline and the communication needed to consistently apply these complex algorithms? Especially when you're facing the immense emotional weight of a patient in traumatic cardiac arrest. It's a real challenge every single time, maintaining that clarity under pressure.
Definitely something to consider long after our deep dive ends. Thank you for diving deep with us today.